Welcome to another edition of the 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. A feminist since she was a youngster, Jennifer Lee has a lot on her mind. And fortunately, her extensive background in the feature film industry as an editor, producer, visual effects compositor has allowed her to, quote, fill in the gaps of her visual knowledge about the women's liberation movement. And the result? Feminist, Stories from Women's Liberation. 9 years in the making, the documentary, released in 2013, explores the significance of feminism's second way from 1963 to 1970. It features interviews with more than 35 feminists, including now founder Betty Friedan, Gloria Steinem, and Eleanor Holmes Norton. It won Best of the Festival in the documentary category at the LA Women's International Film Festival, has been shown on college campuses for nonprofits, and is part of the National Center for History in the Schools. And get this, Jennifer was invited to screen this documentary at Islamic University in Islamabad, Pakistan. Appointed one of the global ambassadors for the Global Media Monitoring Project, Jennifer is also participating in the Boston University Conference on the Women's Liberation Movement. Jennifer, welcome. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Let's work our way backward. How does a 9-year-old become a feminist?
A 9-year-old becomes a feminist when her mother is a political activist in Staten Island, New York, in the early 70s. And I watched a lot of political activism there. The women's liberation movement was going on all around us, and it was discussed in our family.
It was discussed, or you watched?
I think as a child, I absorbed, I watched, I listened to the discussions, and I made my own decisions. And what was coming through for me then as a child was that feminism was a good thing, and I knew it was good.
So what causes were your mother involved with?
My mother was involved with the deinstitutionalization of mentally retarded people in the United States at Willowbrook State School in the early 1970s. So-called whistleblowers, in a sense. Mm-hmm. The parents of people who were in that institution were very instrumental. And there were a few people on the staff. My mother was a social worker. And they tried desperately to get the press to look at what was happening in that institution.
No, it was a huge story.
And Geraldo Rivera did cover it. It was basically his first big break, in a sense. And I watched my mother basically speak truth to power and to stand up for what was right and to work with these parents. And it was a huge eye-opener for me about basically sticking with something, doing the right thing, and the strong differences between right and wrong and what establishments can do.
But it wasn't specifically something feminist. It was taking care of or speaking on behalf of the downtrodden and the voiceless.
Definitely. Correct. Okay. It was not.
Then talk about how this kind of impacted you growing up, high school and college.
Oh, definitely. Well, I went to high school in Atlanta, Georgia. My mother and I moved to Georgia in the early 70s, and I went to high school there. And I loved growing up in Atlanta. I lived in Little Five Points, which was the political activist, artistic, and gay mecca.
So that was even more impactful on you, moving from the North to the South and being inspiring environment.
Yes, definitely. You know, Atlanta is an incredibly diverse city, and it was a fantastic experience for me.
And then you go to college in the Northeast at Hampshire College to major in what, or did you not have any idea?
I was going to major in women's studies and film production, and that's what I did, and that's what I still do.
Now, you graduated college, and then you got a job at Lucasfilm's Industrial Light and Magic. Now, that had to be a coveted position, correct?
Yes, I wanted that job. I worked hard for that job, and I got that job.
I'm also guessing that you had to be, back then, one of the few women working in the feature film industry. So what was that like?
I was one of the few women in the department that I worked in, the optical department. This was before they did visual effects on computers.
So what's the optical department?
We did them on cameras.
Okay.
Optical printers. So we worked with film, We put them into a printer, a mechanical printer, and we created effects. I was one of three women in my department of about 30 people.
That to me seems like such a, forgive me, a male job.
I think that I knew that as a feminist, it was very important to not be afraid of technology. And even if I was a little bit nervous about going into a male field, particularly visual effects at that time, I knew it was something I absolutely had to learn. And the optical department at Industrial Light and Magic in that time was the heart of that company. And I always want to be right at the center of things. So I worked hard for the job and I got it. And it was a very male environment, but I managed to work through it. And I did my first documentary film in my spare time while I was working at Industrial Light and Magic.
And you felt completely comfortable working there?
Yes, it would have been nice to have had 50% women in the optical department, but that's just not the way filmmaking was back then.
Mm-hmm.
And I just figured, well, I want to learn how to be a filmmaker. I want to work on feature films also. And this is where it's happening.
So name some of the films that you worked on at ILM.
Hunt for Red October, Ghostbusters, Back to the Future 2 and 3.
These were big blockbusters.
Yes, definitely. It was really fun. I loved it. Being an optical compositor in the optical department at Industrial Light and Magic was probably the best job I've ever had.
Kind of dying and going to heaven, huh?
Pretty much.
And you were there for how long?
Almost 6 years.
And then what happened to you professionally?
Well, I was working on my first documentary film about an unknown female architect, Mary Jane Coulter. And I was shooting it while I was still working at Industrial Light and Magic. And then I decided to move down to Los Angeles so I could be around more companies, bigger studios. And I did that, finished up that film down there, and started working in some of the studios.
ILM, Lucasfilm's Industrial Light and Magic, was not a big studio back then?
Very big studio, but it was the only big studio in the San Francisco Bay Area.
And so you knew you had to move on.
Absolutely.
To make the transition, was that difficult?
It was difficult to move to Los Angeles because the San Francisco Bay Area has a little bit of a small village aspect to it. And LA is absolutely huge.
Sure.
So that was a little difficult, but it was really exciting to be on the studio lots.
And you had no problem getting a job there, being a woman.
No, never.
And you were hired to do the same things that you did at ILM?
I started moving into editing, visual effects editing, and then I started to work on as a production coordinator. I started to do various other types of jobs. I wanted to branch out from being a visual effects compositor to working in different aspects of filming.
And you were never thwarted while you were on that road?
Always.
And encouraged. Mentored? Were you mentored too?
Mentoring was a little bit more difficult. I think that women are good mentors for other women. And if you don't have as many women high up, you don't have as many to choose from. So numbers of women in the film industry, it does matter.
It's 1989 when you're starting in San Francisco at ILM. And now it's 2014. And I'm sure you're aware of this San Diego State University study called It's a Man's Celluloid World, on-screen representation of female characters in top 100 films. Let me just throw out these statistics and let's talk about them. Only 13% of top 100 films had an equal number of major male and female characters. The majority of female characters are in their 20s and 30s. The majority of males are in their 40s. In 2002, 16% of the roles were female. In 2011, it was 11%. And in 2013, it was 15%. Now to you. 16% of those in director, writer, producer, and editor roles were women. 1% lower. This was in 2013. 1% lower than in 1998. You got to talk to me about these numbers.
Well, I started to notice throughout the 90s and the early 2000s that there were less films coming through my workplaces with female leads. It became very apparent that more and more films were these male buddy films.
Mm-hmm.
Two men doing things with very marginal female characters around them. And I started to lose interest in working on feature films as a result. When I was working on feature films, I was working on films like Ghost, where you had a large female lead. I was growing up in the 80s, where we were going and seeing films that had many more women. And you've seen this trajectory basically spiraling downhill for women. And I think it's a couple of reasons. One, studios are more and more dependent on what they're marketing and what their demographics are. Long gone are the days when people stood online around a corner to see a film like Chinatown. Mm-hmm. And I have to ask myself, you know, are feature films still pushing in the art direction, or is it just a vehicle to sell products?
Sure.
And I think that's a lot of what's going on. I think that placing women in these marginal roles, these sexualized roles, as you can see in the age differences, reflect in the advertising in our communities. You know, how many women older are being used in ads? And young girls see these images and they model themselves on it. So it's all tightly pulled together. And I believe it is very corporate driven. I think we're more influenced by these corporations than we realize.
Doesn't it blow your mind that nobody's become enlightened? I mean, that we're still talking about this and the numbers are so awful in 2014?
Yes, and I think that people have forgotten just absolutely how much power they have.
Wait.
We have all the power to say no to this and to not lay our money down
for these items.
We as people,
right? Touché.
Women too, and
yeah,
people.
Right.
You know, we have a choice of whether or not to see a film that's geared for children that has no female speaking parts. Mm-hmm. If you have a daughter, you just don't go.
Do you think that people are aware? You know, that I hear another statistic that women accounted for 15% of protagonists, 29% of major characters, and 30% of all speaking characters, according to the study of 2013.
The average woman, I think they're catching on to it. You know, new ideas always start kind of small, and people start talking about things amongst each other. And then those ideas become bigger. And then at that point, you maybe have somebody in the news meter pick it up, and then it gets on your local TV news. So then it starts to grow bigger. And I think the idea is growing bigger, and that's incredibly hopeful.
But for you, you said, I'm out of here when it comes to feature films. And you did say that you made your own documentary while you were working at Industrial Light and Magic about this not very well-known architect. Was it not only wanting to tell her story, but it was also, this is how I can best be used for me?
Well, I wanted to make my own films because I absolutely love filmmaking. And I love images. One of the most relaxing things I can think about doing is actually editing a film that I have created. And when you're working on other people's feature films, you know, it's not exactly relaxing. It's
mm-hmm.
a job like mm-hmm. anything else.
It's not your baby.
Pressure. And I wanted to be able to use my voice in films. And I've always had this interest in telling the story of women who have been forgotten. I just feel this really compelling need to do that. I love to be in that place.
So in that place is Feminist Stories from Women's Liberation. What was the genesis and the catalyst for making that movie? And tell us about that process, because it was, as I said, 9 years in the making.
I was at a job at Technicolor in LA, and I had watched a Meet the Press episode. And it was five men sitting around a table discussing overturning Roe versus Wade and how it could be done and if it was going to be done. And they were all religious leaders, except for Tim Russert, the host. And I sat there slack-jawed thinking, how could this possibly be happening in this day and age? Where are the women at this table? And I walked into work the next day and I mentioned it. And someone leaned over to me, a woman, and whispered, are you a feminist?
Uh-huh.
And I remember answering her, and I said, yes, I am a feminist. And I lowered my voice because I didn't want somebody else to hear me. And I thought, wow.
What's worse, being a feminist or a communist?
Well, that's what it's like. And I thought, well, there's a connection. No women at the table on the Meet the Press, and I'm whispering the word feminist. It was like that light bulb goes off over your head. And I said, why am I not proud to be a feminist when I would not be sitting here as an editor in this studio if it hadn't been for the women's liberation movement? Mm-hmm. And I tried to explain this to this woman next to me, and she's like, well, yeah, I know that, but... And you could tell she just didn't want to go there with the feminist thing. So I had called up my mother and I said, you know, give me one example of what life was like before the women's liberation movement. I needed something hardcore. Mm-hmm. I needed one of those proverbial snapshots in your head that your memory bank flies to the front so that you can say, oh, yeah, this happened. And I didn't have any of those snapshots. You know, the Rolodex was flipping around and nothing was stopping. And I said to my mom, give me one example. And she said, well, I remember looking for work in the female help wanted section of the newspapers. And I remembered thinking, I have a vague recollection of that historical fact. And then I had to say to myself, why is that a vague recollection? That is a part of American history. Mm-hmm. And it's a part of history that feminists changed for the better. And it was a huge fight. But I know nothing of that. Mm-hmm. That's not something front and center for me. That should go hand in hand with the word feminism. That's an image that should go with that word. And when you say to a younger person or somebody who rejects feminists, well, could you have found this job in the female help wanted section of the newspaper? They go, well, I guess not. That's a positive spin on the word feminist. I think we have a memory hole collectively in our nation when it comes to the women's liberation movement. There were concrete successes that need to be remembered. If you have a hole in your memory about something that happened in history, that hole sucks in a lot of misinformation from the outside. And you push out the misinformation, like the word feminazi, with facts. And that's what I attempted to do in this film.
Right, because in the 60s and 70s, the concept of a woman's place was transformed. They outlawed discrimination, and that helped to open hearts and minds, kind of on a larger scale, but the more specific things kind of got lost in the shuffle, as you're saying. And that's sort of what spurred you on to make to make this movie. So what was that process like?
Well, I had to find these feminists, and I thought, all right, well, I can Google female help wanted ads. And the first woman I found was Sonia Pressman Fuentes, who worked in the EEOC. And I started to talk to her. And then I went and I interviewed her, and one woman's story led to another. So she led me to Richard Graham, who was one of the male EEOC commissioners who was a feminist at that time. They led me to Eileen Hernandez. From Eileen Hernandez, I went and interviewed Betty Friedan. I got her last video interview before she passed away, and I feel incredibly lucky to have done that. And so I got on a lot of red-eye flights from LA, and I flew to DC, and I flew to New York, and I flew up to San Francisco. And I did all of these interviews on the weekends because I was working 5 days a week. I also knew that I was about to become a mother. And I figured, well, I've got to get all these interviews in really, really fast because my time is going to be taken up with being a parent. Mm-hmm. And so I really crammed in a lot of these interviews. But then, of course, I still had more interviews to do after I became a mother. So at that point, my baby came with me. And I integrated my art, which is filmmaking, my feminism, being a mother, and it all kind of rolled into one. And it was very exciting. And it took a long time, obviously. I was financing it by myself.
I was just going to ask where the money come from.
I was working. I had some money to put towards it. The people who shot the footage for me were friends and my husband, and they all did it for free because mm-hmm. they believed in the project. Mm-hmm. I paid for the flights. I paid for the food. I paid for, you know, the camera and everything. And basically, that's what independent filmmakers do. They absolutely know in their heart that they have a story to tell, and they're going to tell it no matter what. And that's going about making an independent film. It is an art. No corporations were involved in the making of my film. There was no board of directors giving me editorial comments. There was no product placement. There are no ads. This is my story to the audience.
Do you see this film as your history lesson?
Absolutely. I had to figure out the concrete examples of the women's movement, the concrete accomplishments of the women's movement. And I rolled through them as the years went through. So from 1963 to 1970, I focus on some of the concrete accomplishments, not all of them. That's impossible. It's impossible to do that in a one-hour independent film.
The second wave is the most seminal part of the women's movement, is it not?
Well, I would say germinal, not seminal.
Okay. And what did you learn that you didn't know?
What did I learn? I learned that women who worked in the civil rights movement were integral to the women's liberation movement. I learned that the women who worked up in Washington, D.C., fighting for legislation were integral, that the women's movement came from many different areas of the country, many different demographics. I learned that there were so many African-American women working in the women's movement that we've forgotten. Pauli Murray is one of them. Pauli Murray pops up at various times throughout the history of the women's movement. Why is there not a statue of Pauli Murray somewhere?
Why don't you tell us about Pauli Murray?
Pauli Murray was an early feminist. She worked at Harvard University. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton tells her story. But one of the most interesting things about Pauli Murray is that she fought hard on the Hill for the inclusion of the word sex in Title VII of the Civil Rights Movement. Then she also was integral in the formation of the National Organization for Women. And she was African American. I don't believe she ever got married. And according to Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, she was a feminist who she knew early on. Mm-hmm. And she was an incredible role model for women in that law school.
And there must be, of those 35 feminists who you document in your film, definitely names of women who don't have household names.
Oh, yes, so many. And one of the things I wanted to put forth in the film is that movements aren't started by leaders. Movements are started by people. And people come from all walks of life. And I loved going into these women's homes and seeing their homes, which were very much like my home, mm-hmm. and seeing the pictures of their family and back of them on the table, seeing how they lived their lives. I think that that's all information in a film that's really important to the viewer.
Speaking of viewer, that's a great segue. What the hell was that like screening your documentary in Islamabad, Pakistan? And how did that come about?
After I finished the film, I received an email from a professor at the Islamic University in Islamabad, Pakistan. And she wanted me to show some clips of my film to a conference they were having on women and media. And they wanted me to do it via Skype. And I did. And it was fantastic. And they were really excited. They asked some questions. We had a great conversation. Then they asked me to show some more clips via Skype to the faculty. Then they asked me to come and visit and screen the entire film. So I went and visited, screened the entire film. I walked into the Islamic University in Islamabad, and I walked into their auditorium, and it was filled with about 300 women. It was on the segregated campus, female-only campus of the Islamic University, and they absolutely loved the film. They were amazed by it. They said they were impressed and shocked at how hard American women fought for their rights. They had no idea.
What year did you do this?
2013.
Just last year.
Yes.
Did you feel buoyed? Did you feel excited about where these women were going?
I felt excited to be there because I'm always excited when I'm working with other women. I love to work with other women. I love to talk with other women. I get excited and buoyed by that. What I also encountered that was really interesting is that the audiences in Islamabad asked me, how can you come here as a feminist? Or how can you be a feminist and come here and show this great film when all the images we see from your country are sexist?
And what about the images we see of their country?
Well, that is true. And they did talk about that. They felt that our media did not depict them in the diversity of which they are, that all we really see are the attacks on women and not the women who are living solid, safe lives in places like Islamabad and elsewhere. They feel very disappointed that there's a one-sided view.
Was that an eye-opener for you to be there? Did you maybe go in with some prejudices about what life was like for women in Islamabad, Pakistan?
I went in with some prejudices. I went in with some fear. I threw a couple of scarves in my backpack before I went, because you never know,
right? Of course.
And I opened up the backpack and one of the women looked in and saw the scarves in my bag. And we had lunch later with a bunch of women. And she said, she brought scarves with her in her bag. And they all started laughing because you don't have to wear a veil there.
After your movie came out, you stopped working in the feature film industry to become an independent filmmaker.
Yes.
So tell me what other projects you worked on and what you're looking towards in the future.
Well, I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, in Little Five Points. I grew up in a Quaker meeting house. My mother was a caretaker there, and I grew up there during my teenage years. So I knew quite a bit about the history of civil rights movement and all of this stuff and feminism. And it was also a very gay area. Many gay women and gay men were living there. So I knew a lot of gay people. And this couple that I had met, Terry and Iris, became mentors to me. Terry in particular, she's an artist. And now the two of them own an artist's store where they commission local art. And they're also incredibly active in Atlanta, in their neighborhood, environmentally. Atlanta is a very dense city right now. And there's a lot of controversy about how the city is being planned or not planned. All the historic trees that are being chopped down. These are serious issues for the people of Atlanta. Also, Terry and Iris are small business owners, and they've got a lot of things to say about being a small business owner and how important it is to maintain your small business in light of the corporatization of the United States. So I am making a film about them, and they absolutely deserve to have a film made about them.
So you go from feminist stories from women's liberation to something much narrower, which is what you're working on now. And where are you in this process?
Shooting the film and editing.
And now, is it easier for you to get money to make your movies? Without getting too personal?
It was very difficult to get money. I had a small grant for Feminist Stories from Women's Liberation from a very small, a small, wonderful group. I did a Kickstarter at the end of it, but 90% of Feminist Stories from Women's Liberation was done by me. And this film, I will try to get some funding from grants. I will definitely go for it. And I think that the crowdfunding on the internet is essential for independent filmmakers, because the money happens quickly. Grants take a long time. They take a long time to write. They take a long time to get that letter in the mail or the email to say whether or not you've got the grant or not. So in the meantime, you can spend 9 months not knowing if you're going to be granted any money. So crowdfunding works a lot faster, and I'll probably do crowdfunding.
Well, it sounds to me like crowds have been watching your movie. And I think that's very exciting. And I'm thrilled to chat with you and to have a conversation with you. And Jennifer Lee, I wish you nothing but much more success in your future, which sounds very rich. And it sounds like you are not running out of ideas, that you, like I said in the beginning, have lots to say.
Thank you. I had a great time talking to you. Very exciting show.
Well, thanks a lot, Jennifer. And lots of luck. And I'll look for you on the big screen. Join us for another edition of the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.
Thanks for listening to the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. For show comments and suggestions, please follow us on Twitter at Sandy Klein Show. You can also find us on Facebook at the 51% Conversations. The show is produced and recorded by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studios in New York City. Sandy Klein is our executive producer.